Welcome to the SDR Disco Call Vidcast and Podcast, a show designed for brand new sales reps working in the world of tech sales. I'm your host, Neil Buyan, and I'm going to be taking you on a journey on the SDR Disco Call Vidcast and Podcast. Did you know that you can watch this show live with the guests on YouTube? This show is available on YouTube at happyselling.io. Hello, listeners and watchers. Welcome back to the SDR Disco Call Show. If you're joining us for your first time, or perhaps you're a returning traveler, this show is all about the world of sales development on tech sales. And what we typically do is we meet inspiring people to understand their journey of how did they get into sales and how do they navigate their career, to learn from these and then help inspire you if you're about to take that journey or if you're going through that your journey as well. My name is Neil Buyan and I'm your host on the show. And today we are taking a little bit of a slight twist because I'm always in the habit of finding interesting people. And if I find them interesting, I want to share them with the world and let you know about them as well. And this lovely guest is somebody that I came across whilst at my new co-working space in Sutton, Surrey. So a shout out to Oru Space. And obviously, being a freelancer myself, I'm surrounded by great entrepreneurial minds and other freelancers. And this lovely lady is somebody that I saw when I joined in. We got the talking over lunch, and every now and then we're catching up with each other. And I thought, hey, do you know what? I need to get this person on my podcast. So, guests, without further ado, could you please introduce yourself? Who are you?
Hi, good morning, Neil. My name is Elle Batota.
Elle Batota, thank you very much, and welcome to the SDR Disco Call Show. Elle, could you tell us whereabouts in the world are you based and what is your business and what does it do?
So I am an architect and the founder of Studio Elle, which is an architecture interior practice, and I am based in Surrey.
Thank you very much. And for the idiot in the room, obviously with architecture and design, we can kind of get what it means, but what would you say in a simple way for an idiot like me? How would you dumb it down for me to understand what you actually do and how do you help people?
So my studio specializes in primarily residential projects, and I help people create their beautiful, bespoke and tailor-made homes.
I love that. So people come to you with their dream house or dream vision and you help put structure to it. Would I be correct in saying that?
Yes, absolutely. My role is to educate them and to help them make the best decisions for their lifestyle and the vision that they have.
Oh, I love that. Thank you so much. And now, outside of, you know, architecture and design, what kind of things interest you? What hobbies or passions do you have?
My main hobby is cycling. So I am a seasoned road cyclist and I recently got into gravel and off-road. Ooh. So when I'm not in the studio, you'll probably find me somewhere in the Surrey lanes.
I love that. I never would go onto that level. I used to be a BMXer, so I'm a lover of two wheels, and I used to ride motorcycles, so I know the passion about two wheels, but that's something new I've learned. Thank you very much. So as a general reminder for our listeners and watchers, if you're listening to this in your local podcast platform such as Apple or Spotify, please make sure that you give us a rating and feel free to share Elle's episode if it's something that's inspired you to help inspire others. And equally, if you're watching this on our YouTube channel, please make sure that you like, comment, and subscribe down below. And if you've got any questions for Elle or myself, please put them down there as well. But what we typically do at this point of the show is we go to our lovely guest's LinkedIn profile to understand them a little bit more and understand their journey. And as a reminder, all of our guests' LinkedIn profiles will be within the show notes. So if you want to connect with Elle, pick a brain on anything that we've discussed today, feel free to reach out. But obviously checking yourself out, Elle, you're doing a lot of activity on LinkedIn I've seen recently, which I like, and I love your posts. But looking at your history, what we can see is obviously you had started out at Rundle Associates. You've been a lecturer at Kingston University. Cool. And obviously for the past year and a half, you've been the founder and architect within your own business, Studio Elle. So could you perhaps maybe take us way back in the day and back to the beginning as to how did you get into this path of life? And could you walk us through all those experiences as to how you got here today?
So I knew that I wanted to be an architect from a very early age. It was always a path that I knew that I would be on. So that was quite straightforward. And then I guess I fell into quite a traditional architectural path. So our education is incredibly long. We study for about 9 years until we qualify as an architect.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's one of the longest, probably like sort of educational journeys we can undertake. So I did that, and then I just got into a normal architectural practice, which was in Notting Hill. So that's the Rafael Associates that you see on LinkedIn. And I was there for 9 years. So again, it seems like I'm a creature of habit. I really like structure. So I started as a part one assistant, which is basically the lowest of the ranks.
Okay.
And then I worked my way up and up and up until I became an associate. So managing projects, overlooking projects, managing teams, and, you know, having all of that responsibility, which was great. But that also made me realize that maybe that's something I should be doing on my own rather than for someone else. And it's interesting because even a couple of years ago, I never really had any ambition or goal to run a business or to be an entrepreneur. And I still feel I still find that word very uncomfortable.
Really?
And then it's just strange that the floodgates sort of opened at one point where I went, I think I'm ready to do this on my own. I loved my job. I loved the company. I had incredible clients. The projects were amazing. Notting Hill houses, South of France houses, new builds in Cornwall. So they were like everything that you would want to be doing as a, you know, as a residential architect. But once the floodgate opened, there was just no way of closing.
I love that. I love that. And there's so many parts that I'd love to pick apart. And I think I'd like to peg this story as kind of like a founder's journey, right? Because that's kind of what we both are in a way. And there are so many things I can, you know, relate to an extent. But coming back to like the early days where you said, okay, this is kind of the career path, or this is the way that you want to go in life within architecture. And obviously 9 years studying, geez. I think that's more than perhaps with lawyers or, you know, solicitors, etc. But how did you come to that conclusion of, and excuse the pun, but designing your life? How did you know that that's kind of the field and passion that you wanted to get into?
I was always very creative, but at the same time, I liked the rigorous sort of academic aspect of things as well. So the intellectual side of things. And architecture was just the perfect blend of being creative, but also the academia.
Okay. And, you know, taking on that charge of 9 years, how did you fathom that? And like, what was going through your mind when you said, okay, cool, I'm going to go do this and learn about it, but it's going to take this time? How do you rationalize that?
You just take it step by step, as anything in life, you know, the same way we are now building the business step by step. You don't look at it thinking, oh, it's going to take me 17 years to have X many clients or to make X amount of income. You just take it step by step, and it's a long, you know, it's a long burning journey, but that's just what it is.
And I'm intrigued to know, because obviously I've never been in that field or industry. So you come to the end of your studies and you're qualified, and then, you know, going to Notting Hill to join a business at Rundell Associates. What was that transition life of theory, studying, to then actually putting into practice within a working environment? What was that journey like for you?
So the way our education is structured is that we do our undergraduate and then we go into work. So that's when you start as an assistant. You do that for 1 or 2 years, and then you go back to do your master's, and then you go back to work, and then you go back to university. So actually you are always kind of working at the same time. And I chose the path where I needed to work. So actually, even through education, I was always in practice at the same time, because, you know, financial pressures, realities of life. So you do start working, you know, at the same time as, you know, your other friends and different careers, but it just takes a very long time until you actually are qualified.
I love that. And what would you say were, whilst working within that business and, you know, the parallels of studying as well as working, which I think is really great because it gives you the experience, but also to apply what you're learning within that business. But what would you say your key takeaways that you learned within that biz to, you know, ultimately help you launch your own biz? Like, what were the key life lessons working in that industry to then help you come about thinking about building your own biz?
I think everything you need to know professionally, and you develop personally, you know, the confidence and the ambition to do those things. I I know that some people sort of jump straight into starting businesses when they're very young, and maybe that's just something certain people have within them. As I said, I didn't have it in me. So having all those years of experience and, you know, managing clients, having the conversations, writing the emails, having the issues, solving the problems, that was my way of building the confidence that was needed.
I love that. And it's timely said that we're having this conversation, because I was coaching somebody earlier this week, and I'm not going to mention any names because of privacy, but this person is somebody who's, you know, relatively younger, and they're working within a great business, but they've got this hunger, and they've already done it to launch a side hustle, and it's within a creative space. And when talking to them, their side hustle has only been around for 2 months, but they're now starting to get this lull with their current 9-to-5, and they just want to kind of let go of it and just go full hog into their new biz. And kind of the advice that I had for this person was, I know that feeling, but I kind of said it as, you're currently in a place where you're able to learn and test and learn all the skills that you need to really do this thing on your own. And if you can do both, great. Because here's kind of university of building business while working in a business that's already established to then help you learn. But we kind of go through this honeymoon period when we launch a biz. We're like, okay, we've launched that. We've got a name. We've got business. We've got potential clients coming along. And doing a 9-to-5 just bores the hell out of me when I wake up. I don't want to do that shit anymore. I just want to go do my stuff. And I think what you've said is, you know, learning those emails, learning those conversations, learning how to do this sort of stuff can help you do it on your own. So I'm really curious to know, was what was the catalyst, like after working all those years within there, to say, right, now I'm ready to go do my own biz? What was that? What was that changing moment?
I think once you've sort of ran a couple of projects and you faced a lot of the issues, which you think will be quite repetitive issues, and once that confidence gain, so you're sort of filling your cup, you know, all those years, drip, 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 you're getting these skills. And at a certain point, I think that cup is full where you go, huh, I think I could do this, you know, without other people overlooking. So I think that's what it was. For me, it was always the big urge for independence. I just wanted to do exactly what I was doing there, but on my terms, like on my schedule. I lived a commuting lifestyle, so, you know, 3 hours a day minimum on trains, you know, from Surrey to Notting Hill. And I think all of that just takes toll. Also, lockdown obviously showed all of us that there is life outside the standard office walls, which wasn't a concept before. And everyone was, you know, no one had any notion of life could be something else than. So I think it was the perfect storm of like the confidence, the new way of life, and the urge for independence that added up for me.
I love that. And I can definitely relate in terms of, as you said, like on your terms, can you do this stuff, but you want to do it on like your schedule, the way you want to do it and run it. And I also agreed, like the pandemic and lockdown gave us a lot of time to reflect and give us perspective as to, do we want to still be doing this stuff all of our life? Or is there another way of doing this? And yeah, the commute 3 hours, geez, like, you know, back to back, that's a toll on itself. And I think, you know, I kind of, when I did this, like 6 years back of making the leap of launching Happy Selling, I remember working in a tech company and I was really happy in the role. I loved the company, loved my colleagues, loved all the business. But this was a funny thing. I remember once we was in our end of year review, and they're talking about the financials, the company growth, where the company's going, and I just see like on a couple of slides all the millions that this company was making and that we as a team were helping them to benefit. But the weirdest thought came into my head, Elle. I was like, we're making the millions, but I only get a couple of £100 or £1,000 like in a salary. I was like, this doesn't make sense. And it's kind of that idea of, you know, when somebody like myself, who's renting, in essence, I'm paying somebody else's mortgage and asset. I'm like, could I not do that for myself? And to your point, you know, going through a couple of projects. So my job back then was to onboard customers, get them live on the software and give them like training. And you face difficult people, you face projects that stall, you have, you know, objections coming up. you've got software that doesn't switch on when it's supposed to switch on, and you have to deal with a lot of obstacles. But the more you do it over and over and over again, you then start thinking to yourself, ah, maybe I could, you know, do this for myself. And kind of what came about with Miel was that was my job with customers. But what customers started doing was, Neil, we love the software, that's cool. How would you do this sales technique? Because our solution was selling to salespeople. What, how would you do this sales strategy? How would you write a cold email and stuff like that? And I'd be like, El, I don't get paid for that, but I'm happy to help you. But because it kept happening over and over and over and over again with every customer that we was implementing with, it then tweaked into maybe I could get paid for this, you know, and making that leap. And coming to back to yourself, so obviously you've launched, you know, your business. What was that feeling like when you said, okay, I am going to do this on my own. I've registered my company. What happened then? Like, what was going through your mind, and like, how did you handle it?
It was really scary, I'm not going to lie. It's a very, very scary step. And even before the moment where, you know, you've registered the company and, you know, it's your last day of work and you go, okay, so what happens now?
Yeah.
What happened to everyone who has launched a business?
Yeah.
There is so much soul searching that goes behind the closed doors before you even hand in that resignation letter. You know, there's so much self-doubt. There's so many questions. You try to plan the future. What happens in the worst case scenario? Who pays the mortgage? What happens? You know, is this a death sentence to my career? You know, it gets very dramatic sometimes.
Yeah.
Right. So it was really important to find the right people to, you know, to talk to until you're blue in the face and you've uncovered all those worst case scenarios to go, actually, the worst that will happen, you will just go and find another job. So. And then you go, ah, okay, so actually it's not that bad. It's not that bad. So there was a lot of that.
Mm. And could you tell me more a little bit about like that soul searching? Like, what were those thoughts and how did you get to a place where you're like, okay, cool, this is fine?
To me, I like structure. I like lists. I like goals. So for me, it was an exercise of writing a lot of things down. So pros, cons, writing down, you know, what you're currently making, what you think you will be making, what can you cut down on. So a lot of it was just, you know, practicalities of life, just trying to rationalize, okay, so if I wasn't taking in any money whatsoever, how long would my safety net last for? Like, what's my runway? So it was a very rational approach. And I think you have to do that, because if you don't do that, that's when your mind goes, you know, into the really dramatic scenarios where you end up homeless under the bridge. But actually, when you write it all down, it's very unlikely that you will, or you will stop before it gets to that point. So that helped me ease my mind and also see things for face value. You go, okay, so if I have 9 months, if I can live and not make a single cent, okay, I have 9 months. And, you know, earlier you were talking about the journey of other people's, you know, starting the business, and some people do it on the side of their 9 to 5.
Yeah.
And that's one approach, absolutely valid. Yeah. I went the other way and I said, I need to cut my losses. And I just need to dive in and just hope that the safety net will appear at some point and, you know, something will happen. But there was a lot of preparation that happened before I could make that decision. So, you know, saving, making sure you have, you know, the safety net, planning things. So it's never as simple as I'm starting a business from February the 1st. There's, you know, sometimes it takes years of preparation to then finally be like, that's my notice.
I love that, Jenny. I love the transparency, because I think a lot of people that listen to this show, one of their, you know, goals in life is to launch their own business. So they're working in sales to learn that profession to then one day go do it themselves. And I love how you've given like the two examples, like some people, you know, they may be doing their side hustle on the side of their 9 to 5. And, you know, that's kind of what I did and what I've advised some people to do, because you need something to pay the bills whilst this baby is like being born and like being built and stuff like that. But I love how you said, you know, you were preparing yourself, you know, getting enough income and runway that, you know, for those first couple of months, there may not be any work while you're building stuff out.
Yeah.
You know, like where you're finding people and you're doing research to talk about and understand these sort of things. How did you source or find people to ask advice about, you know, to help you make these decisions?
So I looked at my own network to find the people who are already doing the thing that I wanted to do. So I knew a couple of contacts from my old office, which went out to set up their own businesses a few years before I took the leap. Mm. So I spoke to them. I said, okay, you know, what's the reality? And again, you really need to find the people who are, as you said, transparent, yeah, and who wouldn't, you know, sell you the rose tinted glasses that, oh yeah, you just make loads of money and you work like 2 days a week.
Yeah.
To me, it was people that I knew from before. Mm-hmm. And also podcasts. I mean, I actually really enjoy listening to podcasts, and I scouted a couple that I found inspiring, and I just kept listening to them on the way to work, you know, maximizing my commuting hours and doing a lot of reading, you know, books about building businesses and, you know, the confidence and everything else that goes alongside it.
I love that. So, you know, like doing your due diligence. And I think, again, similar to like I said to this person, you were being paid for a role in a job like within Rendell. But whilst you're in your commute, you were taking that extra time to listen and study so that because you knew at one point, right, you're going to end with them and you're going to be doing this yourself. I think that's really important. So what I was saying to this person is you're getting paid to learn. In other words, you can study whilst you've got your job. So do that to enrich yourself. I'm curious to know, like when you handed in that resignation with your full-time job, what were you feeling? How did you communicate it? And once the deed was done, how did Elle feel about it?
I think, again, there was so much that happened before the moment of handing in the notice in your own head and how your mind transitions to such a big decision. So to me, it was more the moment when I decided that I'm going to hand in the notice.
Mm.
That was a huge relief, like a huge relief to go, okay, I made the decision. Now, you know, all that labor of like mental intensity and the mental labor behind the scenes is finished. Mm. But before that, as I said, it was incredibly scary. It's a huge, huge decision. Mm. It wasn't, I didn't go into it being overly optimistic. I'm a realist, so I can weigh up the options and make the right decision. Mm. But at no point I thought that, oh, this is great. My life now is going to be so easy. I knew that it was going to be hard.
Yeah.
But I also wanted the pros and cons to be slightly different, you know, of running your own business versus working for someone else. So yes, handing in the notice was a relief that, okay, I made my decision and now I'm just going to commit to it and go for it.
I love that. So, you know, you've handed in the resignation. You're now officially a business owner and a founder. What was it like? So like this has been going for a year and a half and a bit. What was it like the initial stages of setting up your name, setting up your brand, and, you know, planning like websites? So obviously somebody who's design by life, how are you building all of this and what were the initial thoughts and what would you feel if somebody's in a similar position to you thinking, right, I'm going to launch it now day one, what were those first couple of months like and what were you doing, what were you building and what was you thinking, Elle?
So I think that's a very big subject because that everything that you mentioned, you know, creating a name, creating a brand identity, you know, your aesthetics is basically your shop window. That's exactly what people will see when they Google the name or they Google the service that you're providing or what you're selling. So that to me was really, really important. And I took a lot of time to make sure that it reflected my personal values, my professional values. And it was also quite aspirational. So I wanted to create something that I knew the studio can evolve into. And it took a lot of careful planning, again, going through various iterations of, you know, creating the website. You do one iteration and you go, yeah, it looks good, but actually it's not quite what I have in my head.
Yeah.
And then you need to go back and like redo things. And then I found that developing my sort of the brand, it's an ongoing journey. And I'm still doing that now because as my confidence grows, then I have to feed that back into, you know, my messaging and my visuals and how do I appear? How do I sell myself? It's a long burning game, I think.
Yeah, 100%. I totally agree. Like when I launched Happy Selling, it looks completely different using Canva templates and all of that. And you're trying to find yourself. And I think what I found really difficult was detaching Neil and the company name and brand, because it was kind of a mesh, because I didn't really know how to present my shop window. But I think if anybody saw the original shop windows, it looked like a charity shop. It was just an eclectic mix of different stuff going down. And, you know, a lot of feedback that I got from my early mentors is just like, Neil, when I see you on LinkedIn or I see you on Insta back then, it's really hard to pin what you do or what you offer because you're doing so many things. And my ego was just kind of like, oh, I don't give a damn what you think, dude. I'm just doing what I love doing. So people will figure out if they can get it, right? Which I know is a bit more refined nowadays. But you're trying to find your identity and you're trying to find yourself within that. And obviously how you present yourself, how do you pitch? Because I think it always differed whoever I was meeting on a client side. So when they said, Neil, what do you do? And it was kind of like, I do a lot, but what is it that you need? And like, how can I help you? And it was those iterations. So it was originally sales training. And the slogan I used to help was training the future sales rock stars, right? But that could have been onboarding. That could have been building, you know, a compensation plan. That could have been how to do prospecting. That could be how to hire. It was so many things. And in the early days, like I did all of those things. Like I remember my first year, I was working three different contracts. So one was actually doing a sales role for a software company. The other one was being a sales trainer for a company called Winning by Design. So I was learning a new methodology and training their clients and customers. And the other one was one day a week being a sales coach for a young biz dev team based in Moorgate. My brain was just going all over the place because I was doing so many things. So my question to you is, as you mentioned, this is iterations. How did you mesh together your values and your passions and how you built your shop window? How have you been doing?
I think the best quote that I keep referring back to in these sort of cases is done is better than perfect. Mm-hmm. And you just have to start, because if you overthink it, you're never going to have a website or LinkedIn or Instagram. So you have to just take the plunge, just do it to the best of your capability on that particular day and leave it and just walk away. Because it will never be perfect the first or second or even the 15th time around, because you will always want to improve it. So just whatever resonates with you, just put it out there. And then you'll keep, you know, chipping away and going back to it. So the way I started is, obviously I knew what I was good at professionally. So I knew my niche, which was high-end Notting Hill country houses, holiday homes, you know, that sort of that language. And I like that field. I like the clients. I like the work that involves. And then personally, then I went, okay, but also I have a visual language that goes alongside that. So, you know, I like my sort of Scandinavian style. I like sustainability. And also I know what sort of service I want to provide, which is incredibly bespoke. And I want to empower my clients to make the right decisions. And I want to empower them through the education and help them make the right decision. I'm not designing their homes for them. So again, so then once you write those key elements down, you go, okay, so what, you know, what kind of text do I need to illustrate this? What visuals do I need to illustrate this? And you start just pulling it together, and it won't be even like good enough the first couple of times. You'll always look back and go, oh, I can't even read this. This is so like,
yeah.
But that will only come with confidence. And exactly what you said, I think when you start, you think, you have to be everything for everyone, you know, you just don't have the confidence to say otherwise. You go, anything that comes my way, I'm going to take it. And I'm going to do a little bit of selling, a little bit of design, and of this and that and that and that. And as you said, you go, no, you tell me what you need and then I'll...
You'll figure it out. Yeah. Like
that, right? But don't be hard on yourself, because there is no other way. You can't, you know, to start anything, you need to be really bad at it first, and only then you improve. You know, same as with, you know, sport is a good example.
Yeah.
Any new hobby, any sport, you're going to be rubbish when you start.
Yeah.
But that's the baseline. And then you get better and more strategic. It will be the same with the business. It only comes with time, confidence, knowledge, and experience.
I love that, eloquently put. And I've learned a lot within that. And I can relate to a lot in that. And I think, you know, it doesn't have to be polished. It doesn't have to be perfect. And to your point, there are a lot of things I look back on in terms of content I've created or posts or videos, and I cringe. I'm like, oh my God, no, what the hell were you doing? What were you thinking? But equally, I'm proud that I started at that point. And it's kind of like an example, like when it comes to social and posting, et cetera, and like promoting your brand. I put it akin to like a newly designed house, right? So on Instagram or whatever social media platform, people don't really care about the end product too much. It's great to see a mansion, a house built with all the lights and everything. Okay, it looks nice. But what's more interesting for people is, what did the property look like at ground zero? You know, when it was still in the early stages of being designed, developed, and then going through the trials and tribulations of, you know, the builders didn't fix this, or, you know, this person wasn't available to fix in this lighting and stuff. And then seeing it being changed over time, people like, and it's kind of like, and I'm rambling a little bit, but it's kind of like, you know, those fitness photos where you see somebody that was perhaps not at their ideal weight, and then they have this body of Adonis. People like to see the before and after. And I think it's the same with, you know, launching businesses. People want to know, what was the founder's journey? How did it start? Why did it start? What did it look like in the early days to then having this, you know, nicer version of it, right? And I loved what you said with, like, don't be so hard on yourself. And, you know, in the early days when you're trying to be everything for everyone, it's normal because you're trying to figure out what are you really good at and what do you like doing and what you don't like doing so much, right? Because now, like back then I was doing everything, and now I specifically say, nope, I don't do that. There are great people that do and I can introduce you to them, but this is what I focus on because those are your core values of your business. But I'm equally interested to know, so you've launched your business, you've set up your website, you know, you're putting your name out there, and then you get your first customer and client. How did that come about? And what did it feel like when you acquired your first client, Elle?
Oh, then it gets scary again. It's like, it never ends. I think at first you are freaking out because you have no clients. And then you freak out because you get that client. And you go, oh my gosh, now I actually have to do something.
Yeah.
And you think it's going to be, you know, you're going to jump through one hurdle and then things will be good. You know, the grass is greener. But then it never is, because it just comes with a whole new set of problems. You go, oh, right. Okay, so now I have to write a contract. Okay, I'm going to write a contract. And then you do that. So it never quite ends. But it, yeah, as I said, it was a little bit scary because there's so much self-doubt that goes with running your own business, which you probably don't realize when you work for someone else as much, because there's always that safety blanket that someone else might spot my mistake, or I can just, you know, brainstorm with other people. I can ask for advice. And all of a sudden you're wearing all the hats under the sun and everything is on you. So if you missed something, it's going to come and bite you. And it's a lot of weight on your shoulders. So you are bound to do the absolute best work that you're going to do, because half of it is just like being scared.
Yeah, it is. And there is a lot of fear. And I can totally relate to like having no customers and like, oh my God, I got my first. Wait a minute. I got to write the terms and conditions. And okay, Google template for contract. How do I put this now? Is this legally binding? Is this legit? Well, wait a minute, GDPR, do I need to? There's all these things that go into it. Yeah. And, you know, it's when it comes to sales, for some, for a lot, it's a baptism in sales and learning sales. And, you know, I look back at, I've still got copies of like my first proposals I sent. I'm like, dude, you were lowballing yourself. Why the hell were you so cheap? Because I didn't have a point of reference, right? But from one founder to another, when you're doing these commercial discussions, how was it for you, and how did you learn to have commercial discussions? And kind of like, what were your key takeaways from talking money against a service you're providing to somebody? How did you handle sales conversations?
It's a huge learning curve. maybe because I am in a creative field and we have a big tension between, you know, creative and commercial. And by commercial, I mean, we're probably on the same page by just sort of sales and pitching and fee proposals and, you know, the normal stuff of running a business. You know, you are going to get money for your service. But it was actually really hard to, you felt like you had to justify and over justify the amount of money that you put to a fee proposal. Again, you do all the work behind the scenes, you break down the number of hours it will take and how long this, you know, this is likely to go on, what the risks that you're taking, what is your experience, what is your education, all of those things, you know, go into the service that you provide and you will be paid for. But before hitting that send button, you always just go, oh, I'm just going to reduce it a little bit, just a little bit, you know, because that's going to make all the difference. And it's a huge lesson in self-worth, the value of the service that you're providing, the problems that you're going to solve for the client. And it was very difficult. And it still is. It's getting better. And I hope that every year will get better and easier. It was interesting to talk to other, you know, founders to see how they approach it. And it seems like you do get more comfortable and confident with time. But selling was definitely the hardest thing to get your head around.
And you're right, because I think making the transition for doing it for a 9-to-5, where they've got the brand, they've got the prestige, they've got all the resources and headcount behind it, you're confident charging, you know, 15, 20K to do this or 120 grand to do this, because that's what our business does, right? And I can really relate to that justifying when you're doing it for yourself. So if you work with me, I've had this much experience, I've worked here, I've done this, I've done that, I've, you know, able to do this, 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 this. And you have to justify. And the way that I learned about it was, in the early days of Happy Selling, it was trying to have as many conversations as I could and presenting my pitch deck along with my pricing to find the feedback and how people, it was kind of like a temperature check. And in the early days, like me, I laugh when I look at them now, but when I was charging like two to three grand for something which is much more nowadays, my prices are much higher, I felt, I don't know, like a fraudster.
Yeah.
You know, putting that price in front of them, thinking like, am I a cowboy here? Like, does this shit work? Is this, am I going to get sued for this? You know, and obviously what's the repercussions if this all flops up and just doesn't work for them? But the more I kept just presenting, people saying no, some people saying, yeah, let's do this. But ultimately, you know, finding other founders, and I would go back to my mentors and present my pitch deck with my pricing. And the thing, the synonymous thing that just kept coming is like, why are you so cheap?
Yeah.
I was like, this is cheap? Yeah, bro. Like, for what you're offering, some people are charging 20 to 30 grand for it. And I'm like, what? Really? But then I would also have that imposter syndrome, well, I'm not one of them yet. So I'm nowhere near as experienced or, you know, established as them. So I just had this thing where, you know, when I completed a project and it was successful, even at a cheaper rate, and I had a bit of confidence, okay, I know what the hell I'm doing. The next client I have, I'm going to push the price up even more. But I think ultimately what I've learned is those that pay the least complain and demand the most. And those that pay a higher premium have no questions at all. Because the person that, you know, pays a cheaper price, I don't think they fully trust you, or the ones that are demanding a discount, they don't fully trust you. But those that are happy to pay the 15 to 20K off the bat, no questions asked, it's because they trust you. And years of trying to seek validation from my customers or prospects as, yeah, I can do this stuff for you, it kind of turned into, now I pick and choose who I want to work with, because I know my stuff's validated and I know it works, because I've got 6 years of doing what I do. And equally, what I say to people at the beginning of the project is, you know, I have to, when I get asked the questionnaire, what results can you guarantee us? And to this date, the response to that is nothing, zero. I promise no results or guarantee nothing. And the response from the prospects would be like, well, why not? Like, these companies say they can do that. I said, here's the thing. I'm like a PT in a gym. I can show you how to bench, I can show you how to curl, I can show you how to squat, but I cannot do those moves for you to get the dream body that you want. However, those most people that follow my gym plan typically get these results. I can show you what other people have achieved, but nobody's ever been guaranteed those results because it's not me doing the work. I just show you how to do it, right? So that's that consultative approach that I've had to learn. But in the early days, I was doing all the work. You know, I was sitting with the team, I was helping them build out the things, and I burnt myself out a lot. But I think you have to go through those to then realize your worth, your demands, what you can deliver, and etc. But I'm also equally interested to know, we all have difficult customers. Have you had any challenging times with customers? And if so, what were they and how did you handle them?
Not that I fully onboarded. So I think one of the big takeaways from, you know, starting a business is you have to really, really trust your intuition. So the second that alarm flag goes off, do not ignore it. And usually they go off very early on. So maybe it's the first time you're meeting the client and their expectations are so, so unachievable where you go, look, my professional advice and my professional experience is this. And then they just, you know, outwardly ignore it or go, oh, it's fine, we'll talk about it. And you go, no. Like, you are now disrespecting, you know, my advice. So clearly this is not going to work. So usually you can pick out very quickly just by, like, it's a gut feeling where you go, whoa, no. This client is going to, it's just not worth the time. And also when things do not add up in such a big way, you don't even want to pursue that client because they are going to disregard your opinion. You just end up in a lot of trouble. And I have gone down the route of, like, you know, kind of like trying to pursue them and putting the fee proposal together and investing the time and energy whilst you kind of already know that this is a very bad idea.
Yeah.
So you need to be very ruthless. And I'm starting to learn that, to go, the second I get red flag and go, no, it's not worth my time. But there's a flip side to that. I think in order to do that, you need to gain that confidence to say, you know what, something better will come along if only I let them go. Because if you're desperately pursue something that is not right for you, and that goes, you know, with anything in life, you're wasting the good opportunities will pass you because you're putting your energy where it shouldn't be. So it's exactly the same in business. Do not ignore the red flags and don't go close to the clients like that.
Agreed. It's just, you know, it's kind of akin to dating and being in a toxic relationship. You can have toxic clients as well. And in the early days, when you're not as established and, you know, you're looking for your next meal and what's going to be paying the rent next month, sometimes you will take what you can. And I think sometimes we make decisions which, you know, aren't favorable, but they're the best things we can do at that moment in time. But yes, I've learned the red flags of people that I know that are going to be difficult. So, you know, if I'm going through a sales cycle and they're just being really difficult by being late to the meetings or the discovery calls, or if we have a mutual plan of you get this ready and I'll get this ready and we'll do this, and if that doesn't come to fruition, I then ask myself the question, like, if it's so difficult to work with you before we've even signed a contract, hell bro, like, you know, I'd rather respectfully part ways. But I think, you know, thinking back to myself in the early years, taking on my initial clients, I encountered a lot of friction and resistance. So, you know, where the reason why I got into this, I wanted to work a 4-day week. And for two reasons. One was I wanted that extra day to do whatever I wanted, whether it be my son, you know, go to the gym, work on some music, or just, you know, do nothing, right? And I also wanted to let go of the rat race and employee mindset. So that's why I wanted to work 4 days a week. And that used to pee off a lot of my early clients because I'd get questions like, well, our team needs support Monday to Friday. Why can't you work 5 days per week rather than four on our contract? And I'd get comments such as, you know, we're really uncomfortable if you're not fully investing your time with our company or teams. We're not sure if you can deliver what we're asking for you in that sort of time frame. And what happens if you start working with our competition? You know, And young Neil back then was just like, well, I don't want to work 5 days a week. That's why I launched my own company in the first place. And, you know, when I do commit to working with you, be it 4 days a week, I'm investing 100% of my attention with you during mm-hmm. that time. And, you know, competition, yeah, fair enough, understandably. But as a freelancer, I don't want to be working two similar projects at the same time because that's kind of boring. But if you want me to sign an NDA to keep your secrets in the recipe book, yeah, happy to do that. And when they used to say, you know, we're not confident that you can deliver what we need in that time frame, I was just like, I'm confident I can, mm-hmm. you know. But I think over the years, the way that it's still the same today, but I can articulate it more refined, you know, in a business professional way. But I think, you know, contracts and financials aside, when I work with somebody, if I'm emotionally invested in it and it excites me, then I love to go all in. I act as if I'm part of their team or I work for their company. But, you know, I have heard comments of, well, he's just a freelancer or he's just a subcontractor, like he's not one of us. And I used to piss off HRL because I wouldn't be abiding by their rules. I wouldn't have to be doing performance. Like, no, I, you know, I don't work for your company. And my mantra has always been, I don't work for you and you don't work for me, but we work together. I like to collaborate and I like it on a level playing field, right? But I think you have to ultimately remember why you're doing what you're doing. You have, you know, your own conditions and values as to how you're going to be working with people. And I think those that are not happy with it, they're lost. But those that get it, they will benefit from the work or collaboration that you can do with those sort of people. But that's been trial and error, baptism of fire, messing up, and it hasn't been smooth sailing. But I think a question I'd love to ask you is, how do you define your core working time and how do you detach from it and how do you make sure that you have firm boundaries with your customers when they're working with LStudio?
I try to be very strict with it and it's working out very well. So I do work 5 days a week, but it is sort of nine to six. I mean, it's easy to say now because maybe the sort of the big and amazing project maybe hasn't landed where I would feel like, oh, I just need to do more and more and more. Mm. I have projects that I really adore and I'm really involved in them and I really like the client and it's all going great. But I don't want to sacrifice my life. And that was the reason why I, you know, left the corporate world in central London. And now I'm so perfectly happy in Surrey and my evenings and mornings, you know, where I can faff around. I have such a privilege of having time for once in my life where I only come home at 9 p.m. every evening. And I'm not willing to sell that for any amount of money, at least not now. Maybe, you know, you will ask me the same question soon and I will say something different. But it's up to you. It's where you... what matters more to you in life. I also, I'm a big believer in productivity. So when I work, I maximize it. You know, when I sit down and I have a very important task to do, I will turn off my email, I will turn off my phone and I will say, okay, 2 hours, you have to bash it out before lunchtime because then you're going to, you know, we can sit down with our Oru circle and have a nice chat and, you know, brainstorm ideas. But that means I need to get the work done. So you need to be disciplined if you want to have, and I believe in, you know, work and life balance. It's slightly blurred when you work for yourself.
Yeah.
But I don't want to sacrifice my, you know, valuable things for work.
100%. And I agree, like, you don't want to sacrifice yourself for a financial amount. And that's the thing where, you know, they say time is money, but the thing that you can never buy back is that time that you've lost, right? And I'm very strict. So like Fridays, I don't do any sales work or coaching. I do podcast stuff because this is my creative side and this is the stuff that I love doing in my spare time. But equally, I let people know that if we've booked in something for a recording, know that I've set my time of my day to do this with you. But if you email me 5 minutes before saying, oh, can we reschedule it? I said, dude, I'll give you a count of three. If it happens 3 times, 3 strikes, you're out because this is my personal time. And equally, you know, if I've learned the power of down tooling, so when it gets to a certain point in the day, I'm like, for my own mental health and my own personal time, if I haven't finished this, then I can continue it tomorrow. I've learned not burning all the hours and burning both end of the candles to just complete something. And also I've learned the art of being mindful when I say I'm going to do something. So if a client says we're doing this and said we need this done by ASAP, I will, rather than say I will finish this for you tomorrow, I will now say I will give you an update on this tomorrow. So I'm kind of buying my time, not to committing to getting something done, but giving an update is still equally and powerful. Rather than saying I'll get it done by the end of the week, I'll say I'll give you an update on how this is going by end of week. You know, and respecting your boundaries, I think that's equally important. But before we end, there was another piece that I just quickly wanted to pick up on because I just remembered. So obviously we work in a great Oru space in South London in Sutton. Highly recommend it if anybody's looking for some hot desks. But we've been speaking about public speaking. I remember like towards the back end of last year, you were talking about you went out to an event to actually speak. And I can find the LinkedIn post. Here we go. And for our listeners and watchers, I'll be putting a link to the post by Elle within the show notes. You can have a look through for those that are listening. But for those that are watching, seeing you up on a stage, dude, talking to people, just like at a high level, tell us, like, how did this come about? What did you do at this event? And what was your key takeaway being a speaker at an event, Elle?
So this event was organized by the Royal Institute of British Architects, or RIBA. And it is basically a sort of training day for the members, the chartered architects that are part of RIBA. And they throw that once a year. They invite a whole range of speakers. There's usually an overarching topic for the day. So that day it was aimed at solopreneurs, I never know how to pronounce it, and basically startups within architecture.
Yeah.
So because I was one and I sort of fit the criteria very well, they invited me and they said, you know, what do you think would resonate most, and what is the main takeaway that you've learned so far from being so new in this journey? Because I think it's very hard for people who are thinking of making the step in life. It's very hard to relate to someone who's 5 years down the line, because you're not like, you know, you just don't get that same freshness and that same sort of, you know, transparency and enthusiasm and also like heartbreak and everything that goes with starting a business.
Yeah.
Where when you see someone who's only, you know, two steps ahead, you go, oh, okay, like that's going to be a great conversation. So I spoke to 200, to an audience of 200 people,
wow,
which again, I think I underestimated that event so much. When I saw the auditorium, I went, right, okay, so there's going to be like a 7-foot face of me behind me, and I'm talking to 200 of you. It was terrifying, Neil. It was terrifying. Yeah. But also sort of exhilarating, because you go, okay, so it seems like it's almost the ultimate validation, right? Because you go, wow, those people want to hear from me, my journey, like what I've been through, and I have enough knowledge and value to add to these people. It's incredible. So you stand up and you talk. And I talked about what we touched upon briefly earlier about establishing your brand, defining your core values, and translating that into a website and the identity that you use to attract your clients.
Yes, 100%. And it's terrifying being in front of an audience, but the same way as you said, it makes you feel alive, right? Mm. Like you're in the moment and it's scary. And I think, you know, that's something that can definitely help build your confidence, speaking to a large audience of people. And as you said, they want to listen to me, they're hearing me talk. And, you know, the value that you get from after events when people come up to you to pick your brain, and then it becomes a little bit, I don't know how you feel, Elle, but it becomes a bit addictive, where it's first scary, you have a bit of a debrief, and they think, oh, actually, I could do that again. Is there plans this year to do more talks and open talks?
I am so open to it. And I think it's another valuable lesson in how one door that opens then leads to many other doors. So, you know, after the event, we spoke and then you said, hey, come on the podcast.
Yeah.
Brilliant. And then there was another podcast, which I'm doing next week. And that podcast is the biggest podcast in the field of architecture, you know, business of architecture. And the founder of that was also one of the key speakers. So then he said, I think that's a great message. Come on board and let's do an episode together. And you go, oh, okay. So all of a sudden, like things just start happening because was it scary? Yes. But then you always need to look on the other side of, you know, what lies on the other side of that fear. Like, how many more doors are going to open? How many people will engage with you? There were so many people that reached out after the event, which was incredible. Just, you know, people that are just starting their businesses or thinking of starting and saying, I really liked what you said. And, you know, it was inspiring and, you know, just wholesome. And you go, this is amazing. The fact that we can do this. It's really good.
I love that.
So just tackle the fear and go for it.
Just do it, right? And again, with our show, we never really know who's listening or watching, but I'd love to help you out and put it out to the universe. If anybody's listening in, Elle, and you think, right, I would love to talk about this, or I'd love to do these events, or, you know, get me as, like, Elle, like, what events or talks would you like to do if anybody's out there listening? What would be your ideal sort of talk?
I love just sharing the journey of starting a business. So again, anyone who's thinking of starting any events that are aimed at the audience of starting a business. I love also empowering and encouraging women, especially in construction. It's such a male-dominated field. So and there's a certain amount of confidence and, you know, mindset that goes with it. I'm also involved in education, and, you know, I teach and I'm a lecturer. So also young people who are just, it doesn't necessarily have to be creative or in architecture, but just sort of showing people, you know, your journey. You know, you come from X background and then you end up there. What happens in between? It's, you know, people can't be what they can't see. And I'm a huge believer in that. So the second you share your story, you just don't know who it's going to touch, exactly as you said.
I love that. So for our listeners and watchers from Elle's chapter today, if you think any of those areas is something you would like her to be a part of, her LinkedIn profile will be, so please reach out and connect. I'd love to help out Elle and get more events. So when we are in our co-working justice, so where are you going now, Elle? What's happening? Where are you speaking? I'd love to hear that. But as we've come into the end of a beautiful story with yourself, and I've loved this episode here today, Elle, if you could go back to that young Elle many years ago who's just about to embark on this journey, what three bits of advice would you give to her?
Two come to the top of my head. One is trust. So trust that things will work out and trust the process and the journey. You can't rush it. You can't cheat it. You can't outthink it. So I would never say to my younger self, you know what? You can start a business in 2 years rather than 10. No, because I needed that journey to be the person that I am today. So trust in the journey.
Yep.
The second one would be brave and be bold. Especially as a woman in construction or any field where it's more male-dominated field, you have to be brave and never think of yourself of anything less than, and then go back to the trust that things will work out. And the third one is probably faith. Slightly different from the trust, because faith is more like, that things will work out. So any plunge that you take, by being brave, things will work out and they will lead you to where you're ultimately supposed to be.
I love that. Thank you so much for sharing, Elle. And again, a big thank you to our listeners and watchers on joining us on Elle's chapter. Please make sure that you give this podcast in your local platform a rating and share it with anybody that you think it could be inspiring to. And equally, if you're watching this on our YouTube channel, please make sure that you like, comment, and subscribe. But Elle, thank you so much for coming on board. I'll probably see you in the co-working space in Oru next week, and I'll be shaking your hand and say thank you so much. But again, your LinkedIn profile will be in the notes. But to say, wishing you an awesome weekend, and most importantly, happy selling, Elle.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Neil.
Thank you for listening to the SDR Disco Call podcast today. We would like to get this message out to more and more sales development reps, so please like, comment, and share in your local podcast provider. If you don't want to miss a show, you can always send a blank email to sdrdiscocall@bcast, which is bcast.email, and you'll be added to our mailing list. We're also on the lookout for new guests, so if you work in the world of sales development as an SDR, BDR, MDR, or ADR, and feel that you have an important message or story to share, feel free to email us at podcast@happyselling.io, and we'd love to have you on board.